Hello and welcome back to End of Life University. I'm your host, Dr. Karen Wyatt, and I'm really glad you're joining me today. I'm welcoming a repeat guest to End of Life University, and I'm delighted that she's here to talk about new developments and changes in her life since the last time we spoke. And my guest is Phyllis Schachter. And she is an advocate for broadening the perspective about the choices available to people leading up to and during the dying process. Phyllis grew into this role through years of a long journey with her beloved husband, Alan, whose health declined slowly but steadily in the last 6 years of his life. Alan died in April 2013 when he decided to voluntarily stop eating and drinking, also known as VSED, so he did not have to live into the late stages of Alzheimer's. Phyllis draws on her experience as a consultant and public speaker as a means to spread this very important but not widely known message. Phyllis is also the author of the newly released book, Choosing to Die, A Personal Story, and you can learn more about Phyllis and her work at her website, which is phyllisschachter.com, and Schachter is spelled S-H-A-C-T-E-R. And Phyllis, thank you for joining me today. I'm so glad to be able to talk with you once again.
Thank you, Karen. I'm really glad to be here again, and thank you for that nice introduction.
Oh, you're so welcome. Well, this conversation in many ways is, it's kind of a celebration of the fact that you have now written a book, because when we talked before the first time, I knew that was a goal of yours. It was something that you very much wanted to do. And so I want to congratulate you for completing the book and getting it published and doing all the work involved in actually putting your story out there in this way.
Thank you. It was a big commitment to fulfill, and I thought about it from the time before Alan died. I even told him that someday I may write a book about the story, and at the time I told him that the last substantive conversation that we had, which I took copious notes from, which happened 4 months before he died in December 2012, I told him that I would put the information from that interview in the book, and it actually is in the book. And it was a big decision to write the book because, as you know, you've written books, and it's an enormous amount of output of energy. And it was a stepping stone to say, I want to share this message wide and far. I was a little crazy in how fast I wrote the book, because I had such a mission and I wanted to complete it by April 10th of this year, and I'll tell you why in a moment. But most people, you know, take a reasonable amount of time, like a year or two, to write a book, and I started it last November.
Wow.
So,
wow.
Yeah.
So you really have been on a fast track to get it done.
I've been on a fast track from morning until late at night.
Did mention to me that you needed to go through your journey of grief, really, before you would really be able to write the book and put it out in the world. And I was hoping maybe you'd talk a little bit more about that, about your own grief process and how you moved through that.
That's accurate. And the reason why I couldn't have done it sooner is, from a point of view, I was in an emotional state of paralysis in the grieving process. And I began the grieving process probably a couple of years before Alan died, because he was diagnosed with both Alzheimer's and then 6 weeks later with laryngeal cancer in late November of 2011. And by that point, he hadn't felt well for about 4 years, and we had been going from specialist to specialist trying to find out what was wrong with Alan. Why did he have so little energy? And why was he sleeping more and more and more? And it was because of the Alzheimer's, as we found out much later on. So it was hard for me to imagine not ever being with my husband. We just had that kind of a beautiful relationship with one another. We were best friends and partners in so many ways, and I tried to convey our love and partnership in the book. And as we got closer to his death, and as I got more exhausted and worn down and sad, I just began to lose my life force more and more. Yet through all this, I knew from reading that I've done for many years, I knew that the only way I would ever get out of the grief was to go through it. And I didn't have good models for this in this culture. I'm sure there are other cultures where it's grieving, and seeing a person in community who's grieving is integrated into the culture, and people know how to treat people who are grieving. But that's not true about our culture. And I fell apart, not in a pathological sense, but I allowed myself to be whatever I needed to be. And for quite a while, I spent most of my time alone. I noticed that people were more uncomfortable being around me when I was grieving than certainly when Alan was sick and when he's still alive. People didn't really know how to treat me, and I was like a wild animal. I mean, at first, I couldn't sit still. I couldn't focus on anything. I couldn't watch a movie. I couldn't read a book. I couldn't read a magazine. I was fidgety. I think it took me close to 6 months to probably sit through an entire meal, just sitting down by myself. In fact, today, just in preparation, as I was thinking about our interview, and I was having lunch, and I was just sitting quietly, having a beautiful cup of homemade soup, just sitting there peacefully, reminiscing about how long I couldn't do that. So I acted like that and lived like that until I didn't need to do that anymore. And then step by step, probably took me a couple of years, I began to come out of myself a little bit more and begin to interact and be around people more and socialize more. And I can remember one day, probably it'll be 4 years now in April that Alan died. And after about 2.5 years, I can remember the day I was standing at my kitchen sink, washing dishes, looking out the window, not thinking about anything in particular, and I noticed a sensation of joy inside me. And it was such a huge revelation. It was so beautiful because it wasn't attached to anything. It wasn't attached to an event or a particular person. It just was. And I knew that I was making a shift and that things were evolving for me. And this now is a beautiful time in my life, and I am the first one to be the most surprised that I believe this decade is going to be my most beautiful decade, and I'm going to do it without my husband being here. And the reason why it's so beautiful is because I'm not in a state of losing him, and I'm not in a state of fearing my own death, which was also a big part of my grief. And through his demonstration, I began to come to terms with my own death. And it created a tremendous sense of freedom for me so that I can live my life now more fully.
Wow, that's so beautiful, Phyllis. And as you describe, the book itself tells the love story between you and Alan and how important that relationship was. And I think it's really amazing to see the reflection of that love now on the other side, now that you're still here in physical form and Alan is not. And it's
right.
Still that great love that sustains you even now, it sounds like.
Absolutely. I feel his presence every day. In many respects, I feel like we've written this book together and we're doing our work together. And I know he wanted people to know about his story. If you remember on one of our previous interviews, I shared the story that about 2 weeks before he started his fast of not eating and drinking, he was sitting at our breakfast table and I was standing nearby in the kitchen and I noticed he was crying. And when I said, honey, why are you crying? What are you feeling? He literally said these words, I'm not afraid of dying. I've lived a good life, but I want everyone to know about VSED. And immediately, words just came right out of my mouth, and I said, you'll just have to trust that I'll be your vehicle. And I'm doing this work not because I feel obligated to Alan, but because this just feels like rightful action. It feels like, in a very centered and grounded way, this is what I meant to do at this time in my life. And I feel it's Alan and I are doing this together. I feel like I'm guided every step of the way. This is not taking a lot of effort on my part. It takes a lot of time, but not effort in the way it did when I was a business consultant working with Alan. When I was a business consultant and I did a business plan every year, I worked my plan, and it took a great deal of effort to make the plan and work the plan. I don't really have a plan now. I'm in a state of allowing, and I'm sharing our story, and I see what unfolds, and I'm willing to find the guidance that comes to me.
Wow. That's so beautiful, Phyllis. I'm thinking that maybe we should backtrack a little bit and talk a little bit more about VSED itself, which is voluntarily stopping eating and drinking, which is the choice Alan made as in order to end his life naturally rather than going through the later stages of Alzheimer's, as I mentioned in the intro. But maybe you could just review a little bit about that process, Phyllis, and how did Alan make the decision to use VSED? What process did he go through to decide that?
So when he was diagnosed with the two diseases of Alzheimer's and laryngeal cancer, we had to address the laryngeal cancer first because it was more immediate. And the surgeon said that if you don't have three consecutive invasive surgeries, you will most likely die a very painful death within 6 to 12 months, and you could start having serious symptoms within 2 to 3 months. And so that was the first decision that we had to make and face. And after deep reflection and talking with others who we respected, Alan made the decision not to have any surgery. And using alternative complementary modalities, which we were comfortable with in our life, through using naturopathy, group prayer, and visualization, Alan healed completely from the cancer in 4 months. At that point, we began to really address the VSED, I mean the Alzheimer's. We didn't yet know about VSED. When he had cancer, we had to have an out, because if he didn't heal from the alternative modalities, we didn't want him to have a painful death. So I contacted End of Life Washington, which used to be called Compassion and Choices of Washington, and he became a client, and he ended up qualifying for the Death with Dignity Law. I had that prescription. I kept it in our files, and we never ended up using it. And I knew it could not be used for Alzheimer's, because it cannot be used for most neurological disease, because in order to use the Death with Dignity Law, you have to be in the last 6 months of life, mentally competent, and be able to self-administer the drug. And Alzheimer's patients aren't mentally competent in the last 6 months of life. So that was not a possibility. At that point, I got back in touch with End of Life Washington and talked with their chaplain, their volunteer chaplain. And she suggested that I do some research about VSED. I had never even heard of it. I said, "What is VSED?" And she told me. And very quickly, I came across a long white paper by Thaddeus Pope and Lindsay Anderson in the Widener Law Review, called Voluntarily Stopping Eating and Drinking as a Legal Option at the End of Life. I remember it was 66 pages long with a lot of footnotes and research. I read it, I copied it, and I gave it to Alan to read. And after he read it, he looked at me and he said, "This is what I'm going to do." And his mother had had Alzheimer's. We watched her deteriorate over about a 10-year period, and she was just shriveled up with no physical or mental capacities in the last, 6 months or year of her life. My father also died of Alzheimer's, and Alan knew he was not going to go down that route. So this was a way out for him. And I wanted to read, where is that? I have a quote here that I wanted to read that Alan said toward the end of his life. After he made his decision and read that long article, and this was now, so he made the decision 6 months before he actually died. And about 6 weeks before he died, he said, since I don't know about this, probably not a lot of people do, and it sounded horrible, but now that I've investigated it, it doesn't sound horrible, and I'm going to do it, V-S-E-D. I'm doing it because I have a disease that will rob me of the ability to make this choice. I have Alzheimer's, and Phyllis and I went to visit an Alzheimer's facility, and it was horrible. This helped me make my decision to VSED. Reading a document about this in the Widener Law Review Journal and talking with the medical director of End of Life Washington helped me a lot. So that's how we got acquainted with it. I did a little legal research. We both learned about it, and we didn't have many choices.
And it sounds like Alan just knew that that would be the right choice for him.
Exactly. And in my sharing our story, I always want to make it clear that I'm never telling people what to do. I'm just sharing our story. And for Alan, this was the right thing for him to do. Alan was a very conscious man. He was somebody who had meditated for many, many years. He was a man who experienced a lot of inner peace. He was a man who was always learning new things and growing. And he had to come to terms with the end of his life in a deliberate way in order to stop eating and drinking and be ready to do this. And that's exactly what he did. He had unfinished emotional business that he had to take care of. He had said goodbye to a lot of friends and family. You know, he was ready. He came to terms with his mortality, and he was ready. And so he even said, you know, a few months before he died, when I said to him, I began to interview him about 7 months before he died. I don't know how I had the wherewithal to do this because I didn't know exactly how things were going to, you know, pan out. But I'm so glad I have all the notes, and they came in so handy when I was writing the book. And, of course, for me, it's a beautiful legacy that he left me and left all of us, whoever gets to learn from his story. So I asked him a few months before he died, why is this the most important time in your life? And he said, because of how comfortable and at ease I am with everything. I just feel great all the time, even when I'm tired. I'm present all the time. I'm happy all the time. I'm not sure how to share this with other people. I think it's up to you, Phyllis, to share this with other people. I didn't feel this way most of my life. I'd love to help people reduce their suffering. And now he's talking with tears in his eyes. And he says, I don't know how to do that. People notice how happy I look, and I think that's important because I'm really at the end of this life. I'm sure it goes on. I was burdened by all the things that I thought I should be doing, and I'm not anymore. I have no fear of dying. I'm sure there are more exciting things that will happen to me. And this was just a sense that he had. He couldn't define anything. He didn't know what was going to happen next. But he did have a sense, and about 6 months before, 6 weeks before he died, I actually was out of town for a few days, and I called him every morning and every night. And I remember taking notes while he talked to me when he said to me that as he was falling asleep, people who had passed over were waiting for him. He said, it is a living, moving picture, not a static picture. He said his family is waiting for him, his mother, his fathers, his aunts, his uncles. And then he continued to talk a little bit more, and he did sound like he was in an altered state talking about it, but he was also very present and very at peace when he was telling me the story. He said he'd like to see his piano teacher, who was his teacher when he was like 9 and 10 years old, so he could thank her for teaching him how to read sheet music And he speaks about all this with such, like, soft, relaxed tones, with absolutely no fear. And he says the experience is real. It is not a static picture. And then he says, and I'd like to stay here until my next birthday, which is May 20th. After my next birthday, that will be a good time to go. And actually, he ended up dying on April 13th of 2013. And one of the most difficult things for me was how often Alan kept changing his date. He wanted to live for as long as possible, of course. And he also didn't want to miss his mark when he would no longer be mentally competent and be able to follow through with his decision. He had to remember why he wasn't eating and drinking. The symbolism of April 10th and my wanting to have the book published by April 10th is April 10th is my birthday. And April 10th of 2012, Alan and I went to visit the throat surgeon. And on that day, 4 months after his diagnosis of laryngeal cancer, the doctor literally said the words Alan had visualized. I can find no cancer, and the HPV viral wart is gone too. 1 year later, on April 10th of 2013, that was the first day that Alan stopped eating and drinking. And so part of the writing of the book for me, it has many layers of meaning for me. And it is, so by April 10th, my book will be published. And on April 9th, I'm having a book release celebration in Bellingham, Washington, that's actually open to the public. And it culminates in the most important chapter in my life and the beginning of a new chapter. So that date has a lot of symbolic meaning for me.
Yes, I can see that. One thing that stood out for me as you were telling Alan's story is that the moment he made the decision to VSED, he totally confronted his mortality, and that actually freed him up then to tie up the loose ends of his life, to make amends, to find meaning, and to let go of all the things that weren't that important to him. And it sounds like that was really a beautiful turning point for him.
Exactly. And that is exactly what happened for him. And the gift that he gave me, his legacy to me, is that that's what I've been able to do with my own life. For the first time, I am now in touch with my mortality, with a certainty that I'm going to die, and with a feeling that it's okay. When I believe I came into this life terrified of dying. I feel that I grieved my entire life almost, being afraid of dying. Dying to me always meant or felt like annihilation and suffocation. And now it just seems like it is. It's just another part of the journey. And so I am so present now to that new understanding that I have better health, I sleep well, I have tremendous amount of enthusiasm for living and excitement about what comes next before I take my journey into the unknown.
Mm-hmm. And all of us can really benefit from that message. It's really what Alan was saying is, I wish I could tell everyone this. I wish people didn't have to suffer, because once he got on the other side of that denial of death and the fear of death, he saw what a joyous place it was to finish the end of his life, living from that place of presence and acceptance of death.
Absolutely. Yeah, he said, Alan, when he retired from being in the computer field, he did all the training to become a neuro-linguistic programming practitioner and trainer. And neuro-linguistic programming has a lot to do with beliefs and what beliefs get instilled in us when we're young, especially through language, through linguistics. And so Alan thought a lot about beliefs And one of the things he said toward the end of his life also, in line with all this, is it doesn't matter what you do, it only matters how you do it. I always thought it mattered what I did and how I prepared for that. And now I know it doesn't make any difference. Now I know it's how you go about doing it. I learned to accept myself for what I am and not for what I do. And I asked, what are you? He said, I am peace. I am love. I am loved. Everybody has beliefs about what they think they should do and be. A belief is a story you have about yourself. It's not the truth. I think for me, all my beliefs were limiting, and I've learned to let that go. Maybe someone will read the book and say, I have a belief about myself, and it's not true. If you change your beliefs, you can change your life. And that was said about 4 months in before Alan died, when I had that last substantive conversation and interview with him, when he could still string sentences together pretty well, and I could then edit what he was saying. But his words became a lot fewer after that. So you're right, Karen. He freed himself up to be freer than he had ever been. And so I'm trying to do that now, years before I die.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wanted to mention that back when Alan made this decision, I think VSED mm-hmm. was not well known at all. And when I interviewed you the first time, I'd never heard of it before. But
wow.
Now I understand last fall there was actually a conference on VSED, and I was hoping you would just tell us a little bit about the conference and your experience as a speaker there.
Okay, thank you. It was a dream come true for me. I ended up getting in touch with the lawyer who wrote that Widener Law Review because I wanted to thank him for writing that article, because it was that article that informed Alan and me about VSED. And he and I began to stay in contact with one another. And as I began to make public presentations and have interviews about our story, if I wasn't certain about the legality of something or how to say something, I would email him, and sure enough, the next morning there would be a reply on my computer. And one day, when communicating with him, he said, it's a long time overdue for there to be the first national conference on voluntary stopping eating and drinking. And I just seized his words and leapt at it. And he and our local elder care attorney began to have phone conferences, and we became the core team for an organizational committee for the first national conference, which occurred a year and 7 months later. So we were talking monthly for a long time, at least monthly. And we had a group of people who joined us in forming this conference. It was called Hastening Death by Voluntarily Stopping Eating and Drinking, Clinical, Legal, Ethical, Religious, and Family Perspectives. It was held last October in 2016 at Seattle University. And one of the reasons why I'm so glad it was held at Seattle University is it's a Jesuit university. And, of course, a lot of the negative feedback about VSED comes from religious community. And so here was a Jesuit university that was going to host this conference, and all perspectives, including the religious perspective, would be included. So it was a two-day conference. About 225 people attended. Many of those people said it was the best conference they had ever attended. It was mostly attended by lawyers, doctors, social workers, hospice people, and nurses. And the first three keynotes were the medical by Timothy Quill, who I consider to be one of the most, if not the most important palliative care doctor in the country, certainly centering around end-of-life issues. And he just so happens to be the doctor who wrote the foreword to my book. And then Thaddeus Pope gave a keynote about the legal perspectives, and then Robert Truog, who's a doctor in medical ethics and anesthesiology at Harvard, gave ethical perspectives. And there were so many different perspectives given. After that, then we had panels of people who would speak, and it was one fascinating doctor, Eva Bolt, who's rather young doctor from Amsterdam, from the Center for Palliative Care at a medical center in Amsterdam, actually flew out here and spoke because VSED is so much more common there, and it's so well respected. And, of course, they have the Death with Dignity law there, too. But, you know, having the choice to VSED or use Death with Dignity is an interesting choice. And I know I'm digressing here for a moment, but they're both end-of-life choices, and we have lots of other end-of-life choices. But saying I want a VSED is saying I want my body to organically and naturally break down as it really occurs in a natural organic death. With Death with Dignity, we take medication, and in 10 to 15 minutes, we lose consciousness and are dead in about a half hour. And Alan was very clear that he wanted to have a natural organic death. So I'm going to continue now a little bit more after that segue about the conference. Paula Spann was there. She's a New York Times journalist. She spoke. She wrote a wonderful article, and included in that article in the New York Times was a paragraph about Alan's and my story. We had Judith Schwartz, who's an RN and PhD clinical coordinator for end-of-life choices in New York. A lot of different, you know, a family perspectives. Actually, Diane Rehm from NPR was one of the people who he piped in from, I think she lives in Washington, D.C., or New York, I don't know which, and she spoke. Very interesting religious and ethical perspectives. Every panel was rich. Every panel really made you think. Every perspective that was imaginable was at this conference. And now the second conference is happening this spring, I believe, in the Southeast. I don't have the details right now about exactly where it is, but it's in the Southeast.
Will that possibly be on your website, Phyllis, if someone wants to look up more about it? Or
Yeah, I'll make sure it is. It's on my Facebook page. So I also have a Facebook page called Voluntarily Stopping Eating and Drinking. And I have my website, phyllisschachter.com. And I believe it's on both of them. I'll make sure it is also on my website. If it's on my website, it'll probably be under the events and publications. But it's definitely on the Facebook page now, that I know.
Well, that's just so impressive, Phyllis, that you were part of creating this incredible conference that was so well attended for a new idea that hasn't enjoyed wide acceptance yet, you know, that's just now blossoming, I think, in our country. Like, that's really an amazing turnout.
Yeah. An interesting perspective, Karen, is it's a new thing in our culture, but a lot of people have looked at my VSED Facebook page from India, and there is a religious sect in India called the Jains, J-A-I-N-S, and many of those people die by voluntarily stopping eating and drinking. And I don't know if it was mainly Jains who were looking at my website, at my Facebook or not, but I've had a lot of people from India look at it. I thought that was interesting. So I think it's just, I think the paradigm is shifting, and that's what I'm all about. I want to be part of that shift because I want people to know that they have a choice. I mean, the only thing that we know with certainty after we're born is that we'll die. That's it. And yet so many of us don't come to terms with this before we die, and therefore we can't prepare properly for it, and then we use a lot of unconscious energy trying to prepare for it, whether it's through fear or, you know, lack, mm-hmm. and what we're going to lose. And so, you know, it really wasn't until Alan died when I was already in my 60s that death really became a reality for me. And I was also at my mother's bedside when she died at 95 and a half. And yet, even watching her die, my own death seemed like an impossibility. And it takes a lot of energy to block out one's death, and I was really good at doing that until Alan died. And when we do this unconsciously and we block out this most important reality, it just absorbs so much of our creative life energy, and so we don't live fully. I think the reason why I was able to produce this book in such a short period of time is because of the enormous life energy that has been released in me.
Hmm. Yeah, that really makes sense. And you're so right. If we live our lives in denial of death and we don't confront it, for one thing, as you said, we're consuming a lot of our life energy just keeping that knowledge of our mortality, keeping it under wraps and keeping it hidden from our awareness. But then we also miss out on that motivation that Alan felt to actually live life fully and to actually take care of our unfinished business and resolve issues in our lives that matter to us. We miss that chance, and we might, you know, we might completely miss it. We can't count on having the time at the very end of our lives to take care of those things.
Right. It's a good reminder about taking care of issues, even our most difficult issues, once they come up for us and they're in front of us. I watched him struggle with some issues throughout our marriage, about issues that have to do with the earlier part of his life. And, you know, he really came to terms with and took care of, you know, he got the right professional help to take care of some very important issues. He had time to say goodbye to family and friends. About 4 months before he died, people started coming here and visiting and spending time with us, and he got to say goodbye to people. And it was very meaningful. It was more difficult, from what I observed, for the people who were visiting than Alan. Alan didn't shed a lot of tears when he said goodbye to people. Other people shed a lot of tears saying goodbye to him. And I've had a few people die in my life that I've been close to since Alan died. And I react so differently now. I don't cry and feel horrible at their memorials. I'm grateful for the relationship that I had with these people, and now the relationship is a different kind of relationship, but it continues. And I believe my relationships will continue after I die. I can't say anything more definitive about that because, yes, it's a complete unknown to me. And when I talk about my own death and my own mortality, it's more of an intuitive knowing. But that deep intuitive knowing is deeply satisfying for me personally. And that's all that matters. It's, you know, my death will be my death, your death will be your death, and it will be different.
Mm-hmm. So, Phyllis, I'm wondering, for people listening who are where you were when your mom died, you know, who are younger and healthy and haven't had those tangible reminders of their mortality yet, you come into their awareness, do you have any advice for them? Do you have advice for how and why people should start to prepare now to face the end of life?
I do. An interesting thing happened to me about 6 weeks ago. I went to a friend's house for dinner, and she has 4 young children, ages 5 through 9. And the 6 of us were having dinner together. And out of the clear blue, my friend says to me, "Would you please tell my children about your story and how your husband died?" And she caught me a bit unaware, unprepared. And in a very gentle way, I told them the exact truth about how he died. I watched these children take in my words. They were moved by the words. They were not frightened by the words. They asked a few questions, and then they just went back to eating their meal as if it was just another story of the day. I personally have one of the things that I love the most, my first career was as a teacher, and one of the things I would actually like to do is to go into high school classrooms and college classrooms and share our story. Because I believe as youth, we need to start understanding that we're here for a limited amount of time in this form. Wouldn't it be wonderful if when people got their driver's licenses, they had to write a health directive at that time? And in order to write the health directive, they would have to give some thought to the end of their life. So when one of the things that I've noticed and is that younger people, when I say younger now, I'm talking about like the 18 to 25-year-old range, because a lot of those people also have heard my story or seen me speak, and I've asked them in particular how they respond to it. They respond to it with a great deal of ease and appreciation. They're the people who have grandparents now with horrible degenerative disease or have died from Alzheimer's, and they saw what their grandparents went through, and they don't want their parents to go through it. They can't really see this happening to them yet, but they're looking into the future. So I hope everybody will read my book from about the age of about 18 and up. It's written in a very gentle, beautiful, informative way. You described it well, Karen. It's both a memoir and a guidebook. It's all of, you know, a love story, our partnership, you know, and all the territory that we traverse together, you know, including all the proper medical and legal guidance. So the book is really an education and a tool to pave the way for others who want to broaden their own perspectives about their own death. And I am so grateful now that I am going through my rest of my life knowing that I have choice. I'm a very healthy woman. I'm very grateful for that. And when I go to visit my doctor now every year, I remind her about my health directive. And last year, although she didn't have all the answers yet, she did tell me she would support me through VSED or Death with Dignity. The part she didn't have the answers to yet were the logistics. What if I'm dying and she's supposed to be on vacation? What if I'm dying and she has a full day of patients that day? So one of the other things I want to do is I actually want to work with doctors and beginning to shift the paradigm for primary care doctors so that they have systems set up in their own practices so that their patients can be properly taken care of. Yes, a doctor can call in medication over the phone, a prescription over the phone, and a caregiver could administer it. But really the most ideal is what we had. Our doctor who came 3 times during the 9.5 days and was on 24-hour call, she saw Alan. She was there hands-on. And she made changes in the prescription as needed throughout the 9.5 days. And it is true it could have all been on the phone. And there are people that I have consulted with since Alan died where their mate's or loved one's death was all done by talking to a doctor on the phone. But it is ideal if a doctor could come to the house
mm-hmm.
or a hospice person.
Mm-hmm. And so that's a great call in a way for doctors out there practicing right now who are interested and willing to support VSED. But I would imagine even nurses or home health aides, death doulas, people in those areas who are willing to help support a family through VSED would be, I would imagine their services are needed as well.
Oh, tremendously. So one case that I know about not too long ago, a death doula was the main person. She communicated with the doctor on the phone, and she did the administration of the medication, you know. One of the things about caregivers, so we had 2 round-the-clock caregivers who were both CNAs, certified nursing assistants, and it was hard for me to find the right certified nursing assistants because most caregivers are trained to prolong life with a good quality of life. They are not trained to shorten life with a good quality of death. And so I had to find people who could fit into our paradigm, and it wasn't easy. I think it will be easier now, year after year, but it wasn't easy.
Well, I just recently attended a training session with some death doulas, and I mentioned this to them, that if they are interested in being part of this work, they need to speak up and make sure that they're well known, because they're needed. And so if they can put their names out there as people who are willing to be part of helping a family with VSED, training other people to join in, I think that's something really important out there, that we have more and more caregivers and death doulas who are willing to be part of it.
Right. And, you know, even though my book is written in such a personal way, it is a guidebook, and I do have, in the appendix, I've detailed medical preparations, detailed legal preparations, a article on how to talk to someone who's grieving. So anyone, all these categories of people that you're talking about could greatly benefit from reading my book. So my book is called Choosing to Die, A Personal Story, and the subtitle is Elective Death by Voluntarily Stopping and Eating and Drinking in the Face of Degenerative Disease. And there's a lot of information also on my website that people can benefit from. And my website also has a blog and other more current information. And people will be able to buy the book by April 9th on my website, or going directly to Amazon and looking for Choosing to Die. And I just want to spell my name again, because my last name is a little tricky, but Phyllis is P-H-Y-L-L-I-S. Phyllis, and Schachter is S-H-A-C-T-E-R, PhyllisSchachter.com. And there's one other thing that I always like to add in a little bit that's controversial. I know we have just a few minutes left, and I want to mention a lot of people either clearly and loudly or kind of very sub rosa say, "Did Alan commit suicide? Is that what VSED is?" Because some people interpret it that way. And I think that suicide, you could call it an elective death, but it certainly isn't a conscious elective death. And really, all people who thoughtfully pursue elective death, like VSED or death with dignity, should be granted the respect of terminology that, you know, distinguishes their choice from a sudden, often horrifying, ill-considered, negative choice of suicide. And suicide is secretive. It's usually very violent. It's outside the natural order. It doesn't involve loved ones. It's very hurtful to loved ones. It's devastating to others. So people who are committing suicide are saying no, a big no to life. And Alan was truly saying yes up to his last breath in the most conscious way, so much so that he told the doctor he wanted as little medication as possible because he wanted to be as conscious as possible. And she's a good doctor. She stayed one step ahead of him to make sure that he didn't suffer, and he did have medication, and he had more medication than other people I've heard who have had minimal, even much less medication. So it's a very individual situation. He went into a coma about the last 12 hours of his life, but was in communication up to that point. So the ethics, the bioethics field often talks, there was a lot of talk about the exploration of suicide in relation to VSED at the conference last October, and it just became so clear that this is so different and that we have to find the right language and terminology and not associate that word with it at all. An elective death is a very powerful conscious death. It can be.
That's such a good point. I'm really glad that you added that, Phyllis, because I think that probably does address a major question and concern of people who are contemplating BSED and wanting to know more about it. So I'm so glad that you brought that up. So I wanted to remind listeners, for one thing, that there will be a conference coming up again this spring on BSED, and you can go to Phyllis's website, phyllisschachter.com, to learn more about where that's being held if you're interested in attending a conference. And it sounds like last fall's conference was incredible and well worth attending, so be sure to look up information about that if you'd like to attend that. Also visit Phyllis's website just for information about Phyllis's schedule and where she might be speaking and other things she has going on. And I'd like to give my personal recommendation. If you are interested in BSED itself, Phyllis's book, Choosing to Die, A Personal Story, is definitely the book you need to have. There's no other book like it out there. And it's an incredible resource that you should have available to have this information at hand for the future if you need it. But beyond that, whether or not you're considering VSED, this book is a beautiful story of conscious dying. And I think it's a great way for each one of us to go on this journey with Alan and Phyllis and to contemplate our own deaths, our own mortality, and how we might like that journey to unfold in our lives. So even if you're not contemplating VSED for yourself, the book is so worth reading because of the story that it tells. So I encourage you, go to Amazon. The book is now available on Amazon at the time this interview is being aired, Choosing to Die, A Personal Story by Phyllis Schachter. So be sure and get a copy of it. It's like no other book that you will have the opportunity to read, so I encourage you to get the book.
Thank you.
Phyllis, thank you so much for joining me again for another conversation. I feel so proud of you, and I admire you. You're an incredible person, Phyllis, and you're doing wonderful work in the world, and I want to thank you for that.
Thank you, Karen. You're doing the same kind of work in the world, and what I'm realizing is that there are a whole group of us, and my world is getting bigger as I encounter all the people who are interested in the journey of life through death and beyond, and there is a community of us. Yeah,
definitely.
Very beautiful.
Definitely. So important as we encourage this movement to go forward and grow. So
right.
Once again, I've been talking with Phyllis Schachter, author of Choosing to Die, A Personal Story. And Phyllis, thank you again for being with me today. Until the next time we get to talk to one another, I'll say goodbye.
Thank you. Thank you, Karen. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.